Thank you so much, sir, for those kind words, and thank you all for coming. Yes, I spent several weeks in Afghanistan this year, so I shall talk mainly about the state of the, or rather the non-state of the non-peace process with the Afghan Taliban and relations between Pakistan, Afghanistan and the United States. Now, when it comes to negotiations between the Afghan government and the Afghan Taliban, which of course didn't in the end take place, but which have been proceeding in an indirect manner in various ways, there isn't really much mystery, it seems to me, about why they got nowhere at this stage. And the reason for that is quite simply that the two sides are far too far apart in their basic conditions for peace. The Afghan government and the great majority of the political establishment, military establishment, security establishment in Kabul says that they are not setting down preconditions, but then they use phrases like, if the Taliban accept the Afghan constitution and lay down their arms, you know, we are prepared to give them, well, anything, they say. Rolling government, perhaps, rehabilitation of their fighters, and so forth. The problem is, of course, that as I'm sure you're all aware, this is defined by the Taliban as surrender, and they have vowed never to surrender. Everyone I've talked to from the Taliban, who is close to the Taliban, has said that these conditions are simply a non-starter. When it comes to the Taliban's conditions, this is much more difficult to say because, of course, they are a semi-secret organization still. And the leadership has set down, well, it's set down certain conditions also, which in my view are potentially negotiable. On a Sharia system in Afghanistan, of course, it is the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan. The laws are already broadly under the aegis of the Sharia. The complete withdrawal of Western troops, well, as of the present, US troops are due to withdraw in 2024, according to the present basing agreement, so conceivably that should be negotiable. And a new constitution. Well, in fact, Afghanistan has a new constitution because, of course, after the last elections, the results of which were not accepted by the losing side, if it was the losing side, America brokered a new power-sharing agreement with the role of chief executive, which in fact has no place in the Afghan constitution and which was meant to be ratified by a lawyer jirga. So the idea of, in principle, a new constitution to be ratified by a lawyer jirga as a result of a peace settlement does not seem to me out of the question. But there are, of course, other problems, to put it mildly, when it comes to a role for the Taliban in government. Taliban power in their core areas, and of course that of the Haqqani network, which is now fully integrated into the Taliban leadership. What happens to allies of the Kabul government in the Taliban areas? And above all, perhaps, what happens to the Taliban fighters? Because it does seem to me that if there is one immutable principle of Afghan history over the past 100, 200, maybe 1,000 years, maybe more, is that nobody ever gives up their arms, ever. Not unless they've been completely defeated and forced to do so. The Taliban certainly had no intention of doing so. Now, various ideas, broader ideas, you know, for a peace settlement, have been floated informally by Taliban interlocutors and are also to be found in the reports of the Pugwash conference, which met with the Taliban and the people close to the Taliban. The problem is that, once again, the vast majority of people I talked to in Kabul from the government and security services and the opposition, said that these conditions were totally unacceptable, were not even the basis. So, not surprising that at this stage this peace process was not going to go anywhere, and that both sides are determined to go on fighting, if only to improve their positions at the eventual negotiating table. Now, could the United States and Pakistan have done more to bring their respective... How shall I phrase this? In a discussion of the Durand Line, of which I was present, between Afghan and Pakistani informal representatives in Kabul, many of us decided that we should... perhaps that was... That was an act of a diplomatic intervention. There was a suggestion that we should call this line the something or the whatever. So I shall say of the Afghan government and the Taliban that, with reference to America and Pakistan, they are the whatevers. The whatevers, or at least in Pakistan's case. Is it back? Yes? No? Yes. I certainly disagree strongly with the American decision to kill Akhtar Mansour, if only because I think just because these talks were not going anywhere initially or did not take place initially, that is no reason to give up on a long-term peace process. The examples of such peace processes from around the world show that almost invariably these take a very long time. And yet, I think another principle of all successful ones is that you do not kill the leaders on either side. That was certainly a principle that Britain followed in negotiating with the IRA. Negotiations which, in fact, took place not just in the immediate run-up of some years to the Northern Ireland peace process, but had been, in fact, going on for 25 years. But the principle of not killing the leader on the other side was respected, even, it must be said, after the IRA tried to kill our leader, Margaret Thatcher, in Brighton. But could Pakistan and the United States push the Afghan government and the Taliban closer to an agreement? I think the problem here is, or a key problem here, is that both America and Pakistan feel that pushing their respective clients, I suppose one can call them that, to a peace settlement, which many or most of them bitterly disagree with, will lead to a split and collapse of the Afghan government on the one side and the Taliban of the other. If not a collapse, then they will basically break up and start fighting among themselves. The disunity of the Taliban was on show after the death, or the acknowledgement of the death of Mullah Omar. The government in Kabul is in a very fragile state indeed, both between Mr. Abdullah and Mr. Ghani, but also, of course, with Karzai breathing down their necks from the sidelines, quite apart from the Taliban campaign. Moreover, it seems that neither Washington nor Islamabad can offer each other enough to incentivize the other side to move closer to their respective positions, if only because, of course, US-Pakistan relations are now, in certain respects, a subset of the wider, I'm not going to call it the great game, the geopolitical whatever, between America and China in Asia, in which, of course, India is seen by the United States as a critical ally, something which almost automatically leads to, of course, problems between Islamabad and Washington. So, as I've said, there is a logic, I fear, to a continuation of the Afghan war. Now, this has led, of course, to some pretty severe warnings from Washington. The latest was from Richard Olson, the special representative, who was also saying that Pakistan is exaggerating the Indian threat to Pakistani interests in Afghanistan. And this, of course, has led to fears here, hence the title of this meeting, about the isolation of Pakistan. How far could America go in putting pressure on Pakistan? In one way, of course, America is less dependent on Pakistan now that it doesn't have to run major NATO supply routes to Afghanistan across Pakistan, something that, of course, gave Pakistan a very great lever over America. On the other hand, of course, America's ability to bring economic pressure has been greatly reduced by the Chinese commitment or offer or promise of $46 billion, which is three times or more what America has given Pakistan in economic aid since 9/11. Now, if the United States has decided on a purely military strategy in Afghanistan, including the attempts to decapitate and split the Afghan Taliban, you know, in some ways taking leaf from successful combination of operations against the Pakistani Taliban previously. And if America were prepared to extend drone strikes further into Pakistan in this regard, then I think that would create a very dangerous situation. But I hope that it is realized in Washington that that would be a process with no apparent end and which could lead to very, very grave dangers. In other words, you know, basically, where do you stop? Do you stop in northern Balochistan? Do you go into KP? Do you start firing drones into Peshawar, God forbid? In other words, I don't see that for any sensible analyst, this is a strategy which can in fact lead very far. Pakistan would, of course, find itself completely isolated if China where to take sides against Pakistan over Afghanistan. Now, China, of course, has shown no desire to do this. China, indeed, is playing an extremely cautious role in Afghanistan. All the Chinese investments, huge investments on paper, but, of course, remain purely on paper. China does not wish to get involved in Afghan security issues, despite its presence on the quadrilateral group. On the other hand, I think that it's very clear that China does not wish to see another major crisis in this region. It does not want Pakistan to do anything that would lead, you know, to a, well, shall we say, radically increased American pressure or a really dangerous flare-up of tension or conflict with India. Now, from that point of view, it goes without saying that it is necessary for Pakistan to prevent any more direct terrorist attacks on India from groups based within Pakistan. But I would say as well, with regard to the Afghan Taliban, that you know, there is a great deal to the Pakistani argument that if the United States says that it believes that in the end a political solution in Afghanistan is the only solution, if Pakistan is being expected to deliver or help deliver the Taliban to the negotiating table, then obviously it needs to have links with the Taliban leadership. And of course that the Taliban is based not just in Pakistan, quote unquote, but also among the 3 million or more Afghan refugees in Pakistan, which, as Pakistan commentators have rightly said, the West tends not to talk about, and Kabul would also rather not talk about. However, there is a strong perception among well-informed people and people who are not by any means necessarily hostile to Pakistan, that on occasions at least, the line between shelter and support has been crossed by the Pakistani secret services. Not, I believe, to anything like the extent that this has been presented by the NDS and by Westerners who rely on the NDS for analysis, but there is far too much evidence of the ISI playing some kind of a role in, a limited one, but still, in on occasions, supplying and encouraging the Afghan Taliban. And I would like to say that this is very dangerous for Pakistan, and it creates grave and unfortunate suspicions of Pakistani behaviour among people who, as I say, even among people who are well disposed to Pakistan. So that I hope that even though the peace process is currently not just on hold but in the freezer, and of course Afghan-Pakistani relations are particularly bad because of what I must say are the completely legitimate Pakistani moves to try to strengthen the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan, I hope very much that this critically important line between shelter and support will go on being respected. And I believe, from my own conversations, that that is what is expected in Beijing and not just in Washington. Thank you.